It completes responsibility. There is no freedom without responsibility. And so, if somebody, and I know such people, modern, the young man now, that he's an anarchist, he's a free man, but the girl he sleeps with had 2, 3, 4 abortions, and he shakes his hands off. There's no such a thing. He's not an anarchist, he's just an exploiter.
So, none of you were legally married because you didn't feel it was necessary, it was not
no.
philosophically.
I'll tell you, one night, when my sister was dying, we came back from, we watched her dying and came back home, and my brother came, I didn't know about it, this one that is here, so when he came, my sister still saw him, she couldn't speak anymore, but she still saw him. When we came home, my sister was sleeping, my brother was sleeping on one cot, and I was sleeping on another cot. And my husband, he gave me and my sister, when my sister came, his room. So he slept up downstairs in the dining room. And that night, he came up, it was unbearable for him to bear it, the debt for which he fought together with me for her life. And that was our union. He came, that's when he lied down near me on the cot. And we were just embracing each other in sorrow. And it lasted for a long time like that, and it never changed. And but a couple of months later, and I went back to New York. This was in Philadelphia, and he joined me, and we just naturally got together. Of course, we became the parents of the 2 children, and it was natural. It was just natural that way. So there's, it's an entirely different picture. I would say I have a granddaughter who is my oldest one. She's not married. She doesn't have a boyfriend. And sure, she's unhappy. I'm unhappy for her that she doesn't have a boyfriend. But I don't care whether she has a piece of paper or not. And my children, when they were getting married, it was none of my business how they get married. And so to them, I was breaking the tradition. But to them, they were raised as free individuals. So to them, a license meant a record. And they took license, took a record, they took license and went away for vacation. That's about their marriage. But it didn't upset me because they took marriage license. It's none of my business, and it doesn't mean the same thing. I brought traditions, the Orthodox thing, the condemnation, and these hypocritical marriages. Where I come from, a marriage was bought. You know, the families used to have a matchmaker that used to go to the villages to find another family that is equal to this one in the money, you know, how rich they were, to get them together, matchmaking. And I remember my mother telling the tragic life of her mother, my grandmother, that she was married, she was called in when she was 11 years old and given a piece of honey cake and told her she was engaged when she was 11. And then she married a man who was a tyrant, hated him, and died in tragedy after she had 5 children. The 6th one, he kicked her in the stomach and she died. And my mother became the mother to raise the those other 4 brothers that she had. So I was breaking a tradition, but my children had nothing to break. They're part of the establishment here with the recording. And they took license, and that's all. There was nothing else but a license that they took, which I didn't. Mm-hmm. But my mother, when she was, somebody made it their business to tell her that I live with a man without marriage, and she came to visit me, first of all, I had the children. She came to visit me, and she was, She was asking me, did you get married? I said, yes, we are married. Did you take a license? I said, no. Did you have a rabbi? I said, no. We trust each other ourselves more than we do the government or the rabbi. And that was enough. She says, as long as the neighbors don't know. I was living in Philadelphia. She was living in New York. But my mother was treated by my older sister. This sister is 90 years old. And she got married. She did not get married legally. She lived free love. And she was the kind of a woman that throwing dishes at each other in their free love. Because money was the big important thing there. But she made it her business. This kind of people tell my mother that I was not legally married.
Your second sister also did not marry?
Not my second sister. I come from a family of 18.
Right, right.
This is the oldest one. She's 90 years old.
Right. This is the one that is the communist.
And she's a communist, yeah.
Right.
But she was the one that was helping my mother. I wasn't. I didn't tell her. But if she told her, when she came to ask me, I told her the truth. And she respected me for it. My mother respected me for it. You know why? Because she would say, she'd see you when I have, in summertime, when I lived in the Ferrer colony, I had not only my children, but all my sisters and brothers' children would come out for summer too to my house. She would sit there and say, well, God will forgive you for all your sins, for how you treat the, how you treat the children. How nice you are to the children.
Children took your husband's name?
No.
No.
Oh, they were registered. My sister was registered with her first name first. You have to give the name of both parents. She registered them with my name, Stola. Now, I was Stola until I came to California, where the people were new and they started to call me Kaiser. And I'm always Dora Stola Kaiser. It's simpler that way, and no trouble.
Kaiser is your husband's name.
Yeah. All right, and my name is Spurs, Dora Stola Kaiser, that's my name.
Mm-hmm.
And now when I needed my girl's birth certificates, one of them went through by herself, the one that lives in Detroit, and got it. But this one, three times I started to get it, and I can't get it. Because when they hear the mother's name Stola and the father's name Kravchenko, they look for Stola and they can't find it. So I'm going to go through a fourth time and telling them that they are registered Stola.
Mm-hmm.
Stola Kravchenko. Because you see, this makes a big difference when you go to look for documents. So my children are all Kaiser, the girls, and they call them. Of course, the daughter that is married is not a Kaiser anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Although she probably, I don't know if she carries a middle name or not. But that's my name, Stola Kaiser. In the telephone directory, people have a hard time finding me because they're looking for Dora Kaiser and they find Stola Kaiser. These are all small problems. You've got to straighten them out for the sake of being straight, but these are minor things.
When you did have to deal with legal things, like when you were interacting,
I was the only one in the whole community that had no trouble. In the Ferrer colony, we built our own house, and we came to the lawyers when we were selling the house, moving out.
Mm-hmm.
He said we didn't give him any. We're the only one that gave him any trouble. You know why? Because I have a practical mind. When we came to this country. And nobody told me, I was 13 and a half years old, but I wrote down on a postcard, I, Dora Stola, in Russian, came on this, on the name of the ship and the name of the date that I arrived to America. Without that, I would have no records. I couldn't have gotten any citizen papers when I needed it when I was about 60, I think, I got myself citizen papers. But I couldn't do without it. I wouldn't know anything. And that's how I did when the lawyer came to ask us. So I said, yes, were you legally married? Yes, we were legally married. I'm Dora Stola Kaiser, and we were legally married what year, not year, we don't have documents. It don't happen to be a fire in Philadelphia. There are a lot of the things that burned down. So mine burned down too.
Why would an anarchist pick July 4th as your adopted birthday?
Oh, that's a good question. My birthday was documented on the Jewish calendar. The Jewish calendar is 13 months. So sometimes my birthday would come out in June and sometimes in July. When I came to this country, my 14th birthday was the 4th of July, the first birthday in this country. So I put it down for the 4th of July, and I'm born 4th of July. Let anybody feel different.
When you were outside of the fur colony and you were working like with other people, were you like legally a single woman, like your own property was your own and all that?
No.
No.
When did I have chance to have anything as a legal woman? Before I got together with my husband, I didn't have enough to eat.
Yeah.
Because whatever I was earning was supporting a family with two children. And before my sister died. No, and he was an electrician. He earned better than before he joined the union, didn't earn much, but always better than a button sewer, you know. Mm-hmm. No, I never had any time.
Mm-hmm. When you stopped working to take in your sister's children and to live with your husband, were you sorry that you had to stop working? Or were you
No. I'll tell you that too. My brother that is here, has a boy the same age as my older daughter. And I used to see his wife kept a little boy in white little suits that she did her own sewing. She was also in the dressmaker and clean, pressed and all that. So I thought, well, this would be a good thing to send off to the Ferrer colony with the three children. And I would pay for the children so she could afford to be there with the three children. So, but before that happened, before you could go out to the country, it was still cold. So I had to take my children, my two children, home because there was some kind of an epidemic. And I stayed with her. And while staying there, I saw how she was taking care of the boy. I was horrified. Mm-hmm. It turned out that for many years she was a mental case and we didn't know it. She used to open the child's mouth and throw in the food. And if he refused to eat, she was beating him. And one time when she did it, while I was in the house, he developed a high fever and it turned out he had diphtheria. So I took my two children and ran out to the Ferrer colony because I didn't want to get diphtheria. And I remained there. And when her boy got well, I wouldn't trust on my children. So I said, I'll take care of yours and you stay sick. That's how it happened.
Okay. Tell me about the colony.
About the Ferrer colony?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the beginning of the Ferrer school started in 1907, before I came here. 1907, Francisco Ferrer was shot in Spain, because in Spain, the school was dominated by the church, by the Catholic Church. And Francisco Ferrer was an anarchist, and he worked for separation of the school of the school from the church. And he carried out a school himself, without religion. And for that, he was shot in Spain. And I had the picture of the wall where he was cut that I gave to Paul Avrich for his. So in New York, at that time when Francisco Ferrer was shot, there were many Francisco Ferrer schools started all over the world. In the New York City, the anarchist movement started on 107th Street, a Ferrer school. And Professor Durant was one of the first teachers there. And his wife was later on. They bought some land in New Jersey, and they they moved the school out. They built a school there. There was a little swimming pool there. And that's how the Farrell School came to New Jersey. At that time, there were schools all over the world, Farrell schools. Well, now, when it was time, when I moved out there with the children, I came out there for the summer, when the children were small. I came back from there to Philadelphia because it was unthinkable to live in a summer shack, you know, you had to have. So I came to Philadelphia, we moved to Philadelphia. And we lived in New York, in Philadelphia, let's see how many years. Oh yes, I gave birth to my oldest son in Philadelphia. And from Stelton, from the Ferrer colony, we moved to the Sunlight Farm, to the cooperative Sunlight Farm. And we came from the farm, we came to Los Angeles.
What people were in the colony?
And it was considered an anarchist colony. It was very anarchist. And when the after the Russian Revolution and communism came in, there were some communists there. And that's where, but it came, the fight between anarchists and communists came much later to Stelton than it was other places, because until then they were unified in working for the school. As in later years that they started to do some underhand work. For instance, when we were fighting for Sacco Mazzetti's lives, when we were working for Tom Mooney, when we were fighting the striking miners and the striking weavers. That's the time where the fight started with us, because when we were raising food and money to help the strikers, we would have a committee, two anarchists and one communist, and underhanded this communist would take it to her headquarters, to the communist headquarters, and nobody can get in except the communists. And my husband was on the committee, and he wouldn't take anything like that. He says, I like to see if anybody else goes through, and I don't. So he would take we had a bus, a jitney, you know, that met the commuter train. He filled that bus with the food, and he drove in there and found a place. But when we came in there, and the organizer was announcing that comes from the Communist Party. So that's where, and the Sacco Mazzetti funds, the committee that was fighting for the, didn't get a penny from them. They gave it to the Daily Worker, because Daily Worker works for them too. Mm-hmm. Then this kind of things, that's when the separation came in and the fighting. Otherwise, we were unified for the school, and these wonderful people, the firms that came in. Well, there were many others before that, but by the time they came in the year that they came in, they really developed the whole community. Before, it was, when they came in, there were summertime, the young people came there and made it a place of pleasure. They would sing at night and wake up the children, the dormitories. Auntie Firm wouldn't stand for that, wouldn't let anybody do that. There's places we go to the woods to sing. These are the places where the children have to sleep. And they really did something very great for the... I think this should be a separate... There's too much to say about that.
Mm-hmm.
But the auntie and uncle firm, the firms were the greatest anarchists that did not preach but lived it. They did not believe, and that's another thing. The communists were for propaganda. And and even the anarchists, some of them, ignorant anarchists, in the firms did not believe in preaching, but they believed in the attitude of the daily life with the children, to practice what you preach.
Since you want to go into that on a separate one, I wanted to ask you, where were you living in the period from about 1916 to about 1920?
1916 to 20.
Were you in the
accident? Really? I have to check. Let's see, when did the war break out? And not in 1917? Well, we lived in Philadelphia when the war broke out. This was where the little chapter that I said about going to Stelton, and that was the turning point where we moved away from New York.
Did you take part in anti-war activities?
Well, all these mass meetings, and you know, there were lectures and meetings, Emma Goldman, Alexander Bergman, and I was in all these things. But we had a commune when they were mobilizing the youth for the war. We had a commune on 11th Street, and our boys did not go. And so in this we had anti-war, we had all kinds of things. We were in it. There's nothing to compare to now. It was such an atmosphere of idealism. Mm-hmm. Now, I spent last night in the farm workers' headquarters. Of course, I'm delighted at the changes. There was a young woman visiting me tonight that I got to know and became friends in the first grape strike in 1969-70. She's out of it now. She's a supporter, but she's not did it now. And this enormous amount of young people they're the newcomers that give new life to it, and they carry on with enthusiasm. But nevertheless, last night the atmosphere was all communists. There's an older man that wrote a book. And I looked through, he was selling it there last night. I asked, is he selling it for the farm workers? And they said, yes, he gives, I suppose, a big percentage for it. But I was interested to see what kind of a book. Otherwise, a book for $2, I would have bought it. But I wanted to see, and I saw enough. The whole book is what the communists did in trying to organize the farm workers, which is a big, big lie. Communists are using the farm workers for their own things. So I think I didn't stay as long as I didn't enjoy my stay there, because when I just see the young people that are working for the farm workers with this feeling, that's nice, but when it comes in the elements that are using this, and of course you're not in a position to point it out. You can't do anything about it. I go to all the meetings where I can sell ceramics. That's how I raise $10,000, making them and selling them. But I cannot go. For instance, one fellow, it was last year, he organized meetings for me to be invited to unions meetings, and I sold a lot of stuff. Now, he was trying to get me to that Rosenberg meeting, because I didn't tell him anything. Of course, he could not get me a ride, and he couldn't get permission for me to get in, but I wouldn't have gone to such a meeting because I would have to give my blessing to the meeting. I go to any group that is supporting the farm workers for that only reason. I don't take part in the activities. Now, the people that are giving me money for a senior citizen group, in their time they were Russian communists. They're nothing now. They think they are, but they're nothing now, especially the Jewish groups, where Russia is doing what they're doing to the Jews. So they're a little bit mixed up. We don't agree with this, but you're still for that, and this kind of thing. But then they give me $25 for giving them a half-hour concert. I take it, and I go. But if they'll make a meeting class for the Rosenbergs, I wouldn't go.
What were the meetings like for
You see, these are meetings of philosophy. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, this was a people are looking for education. And it was interesting discussions, whatever I could understand of that. I was just writing down words and studying, but some of it I could understand. Professor Durant was raised in a Catholic church. He was a clergyman. Then he left it, he became an anarchist. Then he left anarchism and became a communist. What he is now, I don't know. But the last meeting that I was with him, we had in the Stelfen school, we had a need for funds. So we arranged a get-together of a meeting in New York of the old-timers, like the alumni. And he was to that meeting. And he said, from up to here, he's an anarchist, but from here up, he's a communist. In other words, he didn't do a damn thing for the school, became a communist. Well, I don't care what he is now, but I meet his wife, and she's very obnoxious to me. Very obnoxious. Every meeting she comes in, and it's, for instance, somebody brings her to a City of Hope meeting. The people there, it's true, most of the people are the offsprings of like my children would be. They're American born, they're the kind of radicals, mild socialists, you know, American born. And I don't know whether they know anything about anarchism. So, because she's the Arnold woman, I wouldn't have the nerve to take the floor and make a speech. She takes the floor and she makes a speech and she starts. Her mother was an anarchist, and she doesn't have any contact at all now. But then years ago, her mother was an anarchist, and how she feels for anarchists, they can care less about it. And I feel embarrassed. Everywhere she goes, she makes the same speech. Then she gives $100 to the nation. That makes it right. I don't like her. And of course, I couldn't even get near him because her friend wouldn't give anybody the address. Oh, there was no feminist special group. The anarchists were all feminists. There wasn't such a thing.
What about the women, like the middle-class women who call themselves feminists?
There was the suffragists, that's a different thing. Then the time of the suffragists, that was giving the women's vote. Everybody was for that. Every year. Even the conservatives, the big vote that went over finally, was not just because of the anarchists. There wasn't such a thing as a women's leap. The suffragist movement existed for so many years, and the majority of people, the whole public, was for it. And that's when you got the vote. But there was no women's leap because we were all liberated. And I still don't believe that women, like myself, I think it depends on the women. Now, what happens to the women that got their vote? Did they liberate themselves? They're still not liberated. Not because somebody else don't liberate them, because they don't liberate themselves.
Well, I wasn't suggesting that the vote would do it. I was just wondering, they were so involved with legal kinds of things, if there was a separation in terms of you thought of yourself as a feminist.
We were not involved with legal things at all. We were not voting because what's the difference between a Republican and a Democrat? We were not voting. I was not even a citizen for all these years.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking if what they were doing was totally different.
It was totally different. Now, we would vote, for instance, my husband became a citizen when we were, the year that we went to the farm, it became a law that no electrician, no non-citizen can belong to the union as an electrician. So while we were on the farm, he went and took out his citizen papers, because otherwise he could not be in the union. But who cared? Now, since he became a citizen, in order to keep it up, you vote. He used to go to vote, and when he went to vote, you know what he voted for? He wrote in Norman Thomas or Eugene Debs. Mm-hmm. He didn't vote for any of the powers. And I was not interested in becoming a citizen. Mm-hmm. I became a citizen much later.